So I'll be talking in English again. It's just so much more fun for me. and I do want to say that we're going to keep going with this subject. And for some of you, it's a challenge. And I realize this. Although it's the heart of the Dharma, the Buddhist teaching of liberation, it's also quite subtle. And those of you who are finding it difficult because it's a little bit abstract or beyond or too high in some way, I suggest just allow what touches you to touch you. What doesn't touch you, never mind, leave it. And be a little bit compassionate to those that have been practicing many, many years and have waited all year for this retreat. Because there are people here who have waited all year for this retreat because we get to the heart of a subtle place in the Buddhist teaching. But I want to start with, you know, the Dharma is full of some very dramatic images of samsara, of the world of suffering and difficulty. And one of them, which I like, is the image of a man in a boat that is being swept down the river. And he wants to stop, but cannot. And he grabs at a branch, but the river pulls him. And he grabs at another branch, and the river pulls him on. And he grabs at another branch, and he can't hold on. And the whole river is pulling him on, and he's just trying to hold on to grasp branches, and he can't. He has to let go. And this is an image of the samsara, where we try and hold on to things that give us satisfaction through usually things that we like and that we need and we want. And then we can't. They don't do the job. And we get swept away to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. We try and hang on and there's nowhere to hang on to. We just get swept through our life. And what we try and hang on to is things coming through the senses. Comfort zone, ezor nochut. A nice place, a nice food, a nice love, a nice good sense of comfort, whatever. Relationships, health, whatever we hang on. And then we cannot. And there's another quote which goes a little deeper or precise into this issue of the senses, achushim, and it also has this same image of being swept. And I'll quote it. It's from the Sutta Nipata. For some people, contact, the point where senses and an object meet. It's enthralling, exciting. And so they are washed by the tides of being. The tides of being. Drifting along an empty, pointless road. But others come to understand their sense activity, and because they understand it, the stillness fills them with delight. It's a beautiful quote. Beautiful. I'll just read it one more time. For some people, contact, the point where senses plus the object meet, it's enthralling, means exciting. And so they are washed by the tides of being, drifting along an empty, pointless road. But others come to understand their sense activity, and because they understand it, the stillness fills them with delight. In some way we need to understand more deeply the senses, ha-chushim, because everything we experience happens there. Everything. And the senses, by the way, include the mind. The mind is a sense in Buddhist psychology. Just allowing in materials, stimulation, things coming in. The senses are described as a doorway, doorways, that connects us with the world. They're only a part of the world. Right now, there's millions of messages coming through radio waves into this room. None of us experience them. But if we have mobile phones, they experience them. And the messages arrive in our mobile phones. We don't know they're here. Because we don't have a doorway to read mobile phone messages. But we have doorway here to read light. But even the light, it stops at ultraviolet and it doesn't go there, it doesn't go there. So it's a doorway. The same with hearing. We can't hear what dogs hear. So it's limited to certain wavelengths. Same with everything. The smell is only certain things. So they're doorways that connect us with the world. And there's something important to understand, that we never are really different from the world. We are the world. We can't be anything else. We must be the world. But we withdraw from the world, and then we need doorways to see it again. So we withdraw from the world into a self, and then we need little windows to come back into the world again. So we see the world from windows. So, and the relationship between senses and the world is mutual, it's azadi. It's not that we have an eye and we see light. It's light is making the eye, the physical eye. Without light, there would be no eyes. The eyes wouldn't work. There would be no eyes. If you have a person who's their whole life born in darkness, their eyes don't work. And biologically, there would be no eyes without light. They wouldn't be developed in human beings or animals. So light makes the eye. Eye reads the light. The two are in relationship. So the world and us are in relationship, creating each other, and the senses is where the gateways to the world, the parts of us that reconnect with the world that in a way we lost. The senses belong to Namarupa. Namarupa you can translate as mind-body. They're part of the body. And they're part of awareness. They go into both places. Nama rupa, nama is like name. It means our possibility for knowing the world. And rupa is form, including materiality. So nama rupa is sometimes translated as physicality, mentality, or mind-body. It's just because you can't separate form from observer. There's no way to do that. The only way form is known is through an observer that knows it. As we heard from Sandhya's comment the other day about quantum physics, without an observer, we don't know anything. There is no world, basically. There may be potential for something, but it needs an observer to turn the potential into a particle, or into a wave, or into something. So the world is made by observer and the world is making the observer. And so mind, body, nama rupa expresses this. There is a teaching that's quite important in the Buddhist philosophy, psychology, spiritual practice, etc., and it's called the five aggregates. The Chamesh Mitzrafim. Mitzrafim. Mikbatzim. Because they're collections. And aggregate is like a collection, something collected together. And what it tells us is that we have an experience. So the senses, for example, my senses, my eyes are open and I see people in front of me. My ears are open and I hear sounds of bodies moving or my own voice. Touch is open, so I feel sitting on the ground. Smell is open, don't smell anything right now. mind is open, so what's coming in the mind is messages to allow me to talk. So all of that is happening. All of that, all these experiences that are arising through the senses are built up of components, of parts, and they seem like one experience, but it's made of sections. And this is the teaching on the how an experience is made up. What is an experience made from? And I have to say that it's a teaching means that in an ultimate sense, you may not need it, but it's a teaching meaning a wisdom that helps us to understand the world more deeply. So nama rupa is one of the aggregates, and it includes the body and the senses. And so sense activity happens. Messages are coming in through the senses into the body and into the mind. And they are received, and in a very quick, immediate way, we perceive things. Tvisa, tvisot, we perceive, perception. In other words, what is the Latin and the Greek, perception comes from grasping, litfos. It's we grasp the world, we grasp, we hold, we hold it, and it's making sense of the world. It is recognizing things. It is knowing. There's people in front of me. It's that perception that works with the senses and makes sense of them, information, turns it into something we know. And we need it because otherwise we don't know anything. The senses just come with chaos. And the perception turns the light in the eye into form. But perceptions, of course, need something already there in the mind. If there's not something already there in the mind, we can't perceive anything. We don't know what a baby that doesn't know what a person is or what anything is. It has to be learned. So the perceptions need an existing structure in the mind. The third aggregate is Vedana, which we actually already talked about in the instructions yesterday. And the Vedana is what is the lived, the power of life is driving us to know, to see, to live. And we do that through choices that we make, things that we are interested in, things that we are important to us, things that are pleasant for us or unpleasant for us. For example, when we are hungry, we go towards food. Food is interesting. Food is important. Food is a choice we make. If we weren't hungry and we weren't going in after food, we wouldn't live. So it's a mechanism for directing us to what's important, to what we need to pay attention to. We need to pay attention to supper, because our tummy is saying, eat. So we don't pay attention just when supper time comes. Dafka, that's the time to look up at the sky and have a, and watch the birds. The supper bell rings, we go to supper. I mean, we can look at the birds, but it's, Vedana tells us, go to what's interesting. But it goes in a very subtle place. I mean, this object, we all see it as an object. We don't look at the little bit of air next to it because it's not interesting. Is that interesting? 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 No, this is interesting. So our Vedana, what's interesting, the attention, is drawn to what we need to pay attention to. And then we have actions and results, and we eat food, and we go to sleep, and we do what we need to do. It's all based on the drives that of liking, not liking, of what we want and what we don't want, our ratzon, our will, directed in all kinds of directions, including into choice and as I say, interest. And that's Vedana. It's Vedana is basically pleasant, unpleasant that drives us. And the fourth is Sankara. Sankara is the structure in the mind, which I mentioned just now, which is a learned structure which allows us to recognize. So it's something learned. It doesn't mean that the world is actually like that, but it's what we learn, and it's the engraving in the brain, the networks in the brain cells, ta'e moach, that recognize and know the world, that they're structures of the world. But they also include all the things that give us trouble, our patterns, tavniot, the obsessions, the narratives, the stories we tell ourselves, it's the construction. Sankara is like a construction that we make of the world. And of all the sankaras, the big one is me. That's a structure or a construction we make of the world. And it's engraved in the brain. A few years ago, as you know, we had a retreat of scientists, and we had really interesting discussion at the end of the retreat. It was a 4 or 5 day retreat, and it was wonderful to teach people, a lot of people from brain science. And we had a discussion at the end about the self as a sankhara or as a structure. And the scientists were basically saying, the self is just about everywhere in the brain. Like it's behind everything. It's such a dominant structure that almost every little brain cell is going, me, 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 me. It's just like spread over the brain. But it's still a structure, just like a tree. And the tree is maybe a smaller part of the brain, and the self is a bigger part of the brain, but it's still a structure in the brain. And sankharas, or structures, are the known world. And it's clearly very scary if we don't have the known world. Someone with, the last thing we want is Alzheimer. Even though I gave this story of my mother yesterday. But I don't think any of us want that. The known world isn't really needed. We are scared of the unknown. When the sankharas, if the sankharas started to kind of get looser, we would feel ourselves in an unknown world. We'd feel lost and scared. On the contrary, we keep very, very busy trying to turn the unknown into the known and build more sankhara. Just a very simple question. Maya, what will happen tomorrow? We're all concerned. How many of us are busy even in the retreat thinking, what am I going to do when I leave the retreat? I need to know what's going to happen to me. You don't actually need to know, but the sankharas are busy trying to make themselves. The mind is trying to build structures, and including to make the unknown known. Too much freedom is frightening. Our sankharas are part of our known world. It's scary if we get free of them too quickly. And the fifth of the aggregates is consciousness. And consciousness is the sense of knowing, the sense of awareness. And it's interesting that in the Buddhist sense, consciousness is always connected to the other aggregates. So there isn't a support in the Buddhist world for consciousness as being separate from the other aggregates, which all of us would like it to be. There's a kind of a sort of a desire for consciousness to be something ultimate and floating in the universe, and calling it cosmic consciousness, and is sort of holding us all like God. But the truth is, in Buddhist psychology, consciousness is another aggregate. Therefore, it arises in a moment of experience along with nama-rupa, mind-body, senses, objects, world, perception, choice and vedana, liking, not liking, all of them come together, including consciousness. So consciousness, in every experience, all of them come together to make an experience. And if they're not, if they don't come together, there is no experience. There's no experience. There's something else, but it's not an experience which has an object and a body and a knowing of the world. Consciousness is always connected, arising along with an object that is seen. There's a really nice, one of my favorite Buddhist texts, suttas. And someone asked the Buddha about consciousness. And someone asked the Buddha and said, can consciousness exist without an object? And the Buddha said, if light comes through the window, like it does. Here's light, sunshine coming through the window. How do we know it exists? And the monk was asking the question, said, because it falls on maybe the wall on the other side. Right now the light is coming in and falling on the floor. And so the Buddha asked the student, if there's no wall on the other side, can we know light? And the student said, no, but it will fall on something else. It will fall on the earth outside. If there's no earth, where would light fall? Would we know light? Oh, well, it will be on some water somewhere. It'll be on something. And if there's nothing there for the light to fall on, would we know light? Could we see it? And the student said, no. So the image of consciousness is consciousness falls on objects and then they are known. So the student, of course, asked the Buddha, but surely if there's no, place for consciousness to land, is there consciousness? What will happen then? And the Buddha said, consciousness is released when it doesn't land anywhere. Usually, what makes it land in us are our sankharas, our patterns, our tendencies. Tendencies are nityot, our tendencies. Our history, our stories, our whole conditioned world. So consciousness always has somewhere to land. But if in the end, we have none of those things, have no sankharas and no tendencies and nothing, consciousness is released. It's free. What that means is up to you. I'm not going to say anything about it. You can feel it as you want to feel it. What that means, consciousness released from any object, it's up to you to feel that. So our practice is in a way loosening a little bit the constructions, the sankharas, bit by bit, so as to be more free and not closed by experience, which is fixed, which is closed, based on sankharas, the known world, the senses which are just there, the choices which are just Vedana, which are just here. So we want to open this world. And one of the ways that we can understand, it helps us already to know that we are made of components, that an experience is made of these things. And a human being is also made of these things. Someone, Mara is the sort of voice of ordinary mind, asked one Buddhist nun called Vajira, how is a human being made? Tell me. And Vajira said, I'm not answering you because you are assuming a human being exists. Don't assume a human being exists. It's a bunch of, what's that word again?
Mikbatsim.
It's a bunch of aggregates. Where's a human being? Put together by a bunch of aggregates. When the Buddha was asked, where do you go when you die? He answered, can you really see me when I'm still alive? I'm standing right in front of you. Can you see me? Do you know what I am? I'm just a bunch of aggregates. So if you can't see me when I'm alive, how could possibly can you know anything about me when I die? Just a bunch of aggregates, a collection. So So self is a construction and a convention, an agreement, and is something we learn. Objects are a convention, an agreement, and is something we learn. Perceptions are an object, an agreement, is something that we learn. And to a little bit loosen this automatic collection that we make around an experience, where we don't know in an experience that there's consciousness, vedana, sankharas, we don't know, we just experience. That is ignorance. We just experience and we don't know. So we experience a self and we operate as a self in the world. Just be a self. We don't know that the self is constructed from many things, and we can see that it's an agreement, doesn't really exist. It's put together by many parts. I just have to just remember a joke by Rudyard Kipling, who wrote, the Victorian author who wrote The Jungle Book and other books. And when he met the camel, the gamal, his comment was, "Oh, it's a strange animal. It must have been put together by a committee." So we're a bit put together by a committee of all the different parts that make us up. And we need to see that. So let's a little bit examine, what that means, how we can feel, we can practice with all these elements, and how they help us to look at us like this, how it helps us to be free, to see with wisdom, and not be on the automatic pilot, swept, like in the quotes that I gave you before, swept along with ignorance, our whole life, not seeing anything, just swept along. How can we, you know, stop this and look straight at what is a human being and what is an experience? And how do they help, the aggregates help us in this? So the first, I just want to pay attention to first of all, the body, nama rupa, and nama rupa. If we look at the body, of course we see that it's made up of many things, and including the senses. The senses need input. They need, we have senses of this, senses of that, and then we have a body. So we're already in the nama rupa, in the body world, we already see that we're made up of many, many things. It's not one thing. And it changes all the time. And that's what we're doing, practice, in a way, vipassana practice. We look at the breath, we realize the breath is constantly changing. And so the body is made up of many things. And it's just body. So nama rupa is just body. It's just body. So bodiness of the body tells us that there is a body. Perceptions are really interesting. The key text here is the Bahaya Sutta. And the Bahaya Sutta basically says, in the seen, there is only what is seen. In the here, in the heard, there is only the heard. And I'm reading it from the translation. In the, what is sensed, there is only, or touched, there is only the sensed. In what is known by the mind, there is only what is coming into the mind. And you should see that, indeed, there is no thing here. It's just what is coming into the mind, into the senses. There's no thing. And since, Bahia, there is for you in the seen only the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the sensed only the sense, in the known with the mind only the cognized, and you see that there is no thing here, you will see here, there's no thing, it's just sense. You will see that indeed there is no thing there. There's no thing here. Ein davar here. Ein davar sham there. There is, and if you see that there's no thing here, no thing there, you are not in the world of this, nor the world of that, nor any place in between. And I just want to give two small examples. When we had family retreats here, I used to play games with the children, with bells. And the children would be in the room here and we'd ring the bell and we'd ask them, where is the bell? And they say, well, the bell is there. But where do you hear the bell? Oh, the bell is here, here. So where is the sound of the bell? Oh, the bell is there. The sound of the bell is everywhere. So where is the bell? Is it here? Is it there? Where can you define sound of bell? Sound of bell is not, no place. Therefore, what is bell? Where is bell? And where is the person when experiencing bell? I remember a very powerful experience for me was when I was walking in the mountains of Switzerland. Some of you heard this story before. But I've had old history of being afraid of heights, fear of height, which is going back to my childhood. And I practiced with it, and I thought that it had gone. And I practiced with it while building my house and on the roof, and practiced with actually practiced standing on the edge of the roof and looking down to Shnei Kumot and just looking down and feeling the feelings and practicing with it. And I thought that I'd solved the problem of the fear of heights. And then I was in Switzerland. I was walking along a path in the Alps, and all of a sudden, one side dropped. The path was there, and one side was a sheer zug, a cliff, and it was like 1-2 kilometers down. I was like, whoa, just straight like this. So I kind of moved to the path and moved away and sort of, and all of a sudden the other side dropped as well. I just didn't read the map. And I couldn't go back because it was afternoon and there was like, I'd walked already 6 hours and I had to go down to the village in Switzerland. I had to go forward. I couldn't go back. As soon as I saw that side fall down and the path was like this wide and there was like that total and that, as it all came back, I just about vomited. I felt terrible nausea, bechila. My mind was, and I just collapsed on the ground. It was so biological and so deep and so strong, I collapsed on the ground. And I was lying there. And I was lying there with my face on the ground and thought, wait a minute. After all these years of Dharma practice, this isn't a very, very dignified situation to be in. I have to deal with this somehow. So I sat up and breathed. And actually I thought about this whole world of perception. And I realized that the arising of fear needs aggregates. It needs a combination of things. It needs history, tendency, my past fear of heights. It needs perception. It needs senses to see, but it needs perception to tell me this is a sheer, this is kilometers of drop. It needs many other things. It needs a body that has bechila and fear. It needs many things all put together. And I realized if I would cut out some of those aggregates, I could actually cope with it. And so what I did is very actively, I looked on the right side and on the left side at the colors way down. But they weren't way down if I just saw them as a tiny little spot of red. Few spots of red, that's all they were. As soon as I thought of them as roofs of houses way down in a village like 2 kilometers down, then it was disaster. But as long as I saw them as red spots, and the trees way down as green spots, and they're way down little spots, like pixelim, it has no interest. Taking the perception out of it, taking the sankhara and the memory out of it, taking the mind out of it, really, and then it was no problem. The experience, in a way, disintegrated. And I could keep it going for like 5-10 minutes and I would walk like that, but then as soon as my concentration a little bit shook, then the whole thing came back and I fell down again. And then I got up, breathed a bit, and this way I got back safely. But we can do this all the time. The sound of the planes yesterday that disturbed us. We allowed the plane to disturb us because we have a concept disturbance, because we have a memory of something, because we expect silence, because we don't like to be sprayed with the pesticidium, because of many reasons. We don't like this sound of the plane a couple of days ago. But where is the disturbance? It's not in the sound. It's in here. We put it together. Therefore, we are disturbing the sound, not the sound disturbing us. Sound is just sound. We turn it into a disturbance. Therefore, we are disturbing the sound, not the sound disturbing us. These kind of understandings of taking to pieces our experience and taking, in a way, responsibility for the way we construct experience by looking at it carefully and taking it to pieces, there is a liberating practice for us. That frees us in, like, the small story of my fear, but it's also the story of everything. How we build our selves, how we build our problems, how we build our issues, how we build our, it's the same. I'm reading for time. Vedana, is it a good place for us to practice? And we've talked about this a couple of days ago as in part of the instructions here. Have a look at Vedana, just as it is. The bell rings for lunch, good feeling. Sitting with the back hurting, unpleasant feeling. That's all it is. Do we build on top of it anything? Do we add to it sankharas and perceptions and consciousness and all the other things, and build stories, and build, oh, it's always like that, my back is always hurting in retreats, I'm a terrible meditator because my back is hurting. And are we doing anything with it? Is it being built? So Vedana is quite a good place because it's fast, but it's clear. I go there. It pushes me there. Ratzon. To meditate on ratzon. On cheshek. On pushing, pulling, pushing, pulling. All the way, desire and aversion is pulling us and pushing us and pulling us. Very fast and very, all the time. Nice, not nice. This bird sound or walking outside, lovely. Playing or whatever, not lovely. All the time. So it's a good place to work to undo the habits of construction. Sankaras, very obvious place for us to work, to take to pieces our experience, to get close to our experience, construct the way we construct our objects. It's a lot of meditation is about that. It's all the way we do psychology on ourself. You could say self-psychology, vipassana, the way we see our patterns and our habits and our stories and our narratives and our tendencies and our history and all of that. That's a lot of what we're doing. And so here I'm just putting it in a theoretical framework of the aggregates. But a lot of what we're doing is taking the sankharas, taking it, looking at the sankhara directly. If we look at it directly, it's less me. We don't build a me. The sankhara, we don't add them, we don't build it up to an automatic subject here, giving us trouble. Objects, are they there? There's a nice story of the tradition where two monks are sitting in the forest and a beautiful woman rushes by. And after 5 minutes, a man comes running up. And the man said, "Did you see a beautiful woman? She's my wife and she's running away from me and I want to catch her." And one monk said, "No, I didn't." So the man left and the other monk said, "Wait a minute. You spoke an untruth. You lied. The woman passed by." And the monk said, "No, no, I didn't see a woman. I just saw teeth passing by." We take reality to pieces. This is the object. If we look at an object, you know, can we really, this object is made of so many things. A carpenter would see wood. Someone else would see this. Someone else would just see it's for function. It's a bell, it's for ringing bells. Someone else would see a stick, which is nice. Someone else would want to put it on their shelf and because it looked nice. Someone else would use it as a stick and would love to hit their partners with it and take it home for that. Everyone would see this thing in a different way or nothing. And if someone would look at a little piece of it and every person would look at it differently and every animal would look at it differently. My dog would be delighted to have it and put it in its teeth. Would think, "This is exactly a gift for me to play with." Everyone would look at this thing differently. So where's the object? What is this object? Consciousness is more subtle to see, but we can be with consciousness too. It's just the sense of knowing. It comes with the other things, with the objects too, but it also, we can look at it and know, and a sense of being here, of being present, of just knowing we exist, of knowing the knowing. So a lot of Dharma practice is about what you call deconstruction. To undo the constructions we make, which then imprison us inside them. When the self is looked at straight in the eyes, we see it's made of all these pieces, and it collapses. It doesn't It cannot exist ourself forever if we look carefully at what is this experience, the me. Experience takes things to, we're looking at experience, it goes to pieces. Whenever we look at an experience, it goes to pieces because it's made up of pieces. So we just look at an experience, we're looking at the truth of it. It's made up of pieces, so that's what we see, because it's a truth. It's not, we're living in untruth by what in Sanskrit you call maya, by the dream, by looking at the dream of things being assumed to be as they are. Belief in the self, belief that this is this object, we all agree this is what this object is, a belief that this is a bell stick, belief that this is a bell. And we'll agree, and it's fine to agree because we need to ring the bell now and then. But we still, if we look carefully, things don't stay together. We talked about this with walking meditation. And so I want to read really also a nice, the Dharma texts are full of really beautiful images and stories. And an image and a story about this, and I'll read it just as the text says. It's about a king. And the king is always an image for us, for me. Suppose there was a king who had never heard the sound of a lute. A lute is oud, or a sitar, doesn't matter really. Or a guitar, but let's just call it oud. He might hear the sound of a lute and say, "What's that sound? Can you tell me? It's so delightful, it's so intoxicating, it's so exciting and so wonderful." And all the people in his court would say, "That, king, is called a lute, whose sound is so delightful and intoxicating and thrilling." And then he would say, "Go and fetch me the lute." And they would fetch it. And say, "Here is the lute, whose sound is so delightful and intoxicating and exciting." And he would say, no, I didn't ask for the lute. I asked for the sound." And they would say, this lute, sir, is made of many, many components. It's through the activity of all these components that the sound is made. Depending on the body of the lute, and the skin, and the neck, and the frame, and the strings, and the bridge, and a person playing it. So all these things, that this lute is made of many, many parts, a great many parts, all these make sound through the activity of many components, many parts. And then the king got angry. And he split the lute into 10 pieces, into 100 pieces. And having split it into 100 pieces, he would then shave it into tiny splinters of wood. And then he would burn it in a fire. And having burnt it in a fire, he would make it ashes. And having made the ashes, he would throw the ashes into the wind. And he would say, this is a bad thing, this lute, whatever a lute really is. It has tricked people so long. People have been so long deceived by this lute. And in the same way, a practitioner, a meditator, looks at form, however far form goes, as far as we can, we look at form, nama rupa. He looks at feeling. He looks at perception. He looks at sankharas. He looks at consciousness. However far he can look at consciousness. And as he looks at these things, any thoughts of me or mine or I am just don't occur anymore. So if we look at the thing, it's a fiction. The lute doesn't make the music. It's all the different parts of the lute that make the music. It's a trick. It's a sheker to say a lute makes music. It's all the different pieces of the lute, plus the person, plus this, and it's what I said yesterday about the food in the restaurant. All the whole world it takes to make a meal. From the sun to the water to the earth to the person to the shop to the, that makes a meal. It's an illusion to say the meal exists on its own. The self exists on its own. Illusion. So we need to kind of be a witness, Ed, to witness the arising of experience, just seeing it comes and goes, its awareness, its body, its senses, is just appearing. It's just appearing. Experiences are just appearing. Morphine. And a sense that conditions collect together to make an experience and then go to pieces again. Conditions, which include everything here and the world, all come together for a moment, make an experience, and go to pieces again. And there's something, this is practice to see this. It's deep practice. It teaches us deeply not to hold on, not to cling to illusions. And it invites awakening. This practice of the truth of things being put together and falling to pieces and put together and falling to pieces, it invites awakening. It isn't itself awakening, but it's the invitation to awakening. Okay, so let's take a few more quiet moments together.